Hey guys, I'm your host Tara A. Devlin, and welcome to this week's episode of Kowabana, True Japanese Scary Stories from Around the Internet. Before we kick this week's episode off, I'd like to remind everyone that we have a store full of exclusive Japanese horror art. You can grab shirts, mugs, stickers, hats, and much more, all at kowabana.store. That's kowabana.store. We're adding new designs all the time, so do check it out. Well, we've passed the big 100. I hope you enjoyed that extra long episode. This week, we're looking at another of my favourite subjects, creepy old customs. The countryside of Japan apparently has a whole bunch of these, so this week, we're going to share a few of them with you. First up is a tale of a terrifying mountain and a custom that went horribly, horribly wrong. This one's called Tenpopo-sama. My hometown has a strange custom. There's this mountain that's only about 200 meters above sea level, so it's not very big, but the entire mountain is surrounded by old sacred rope. Not only are women not allowed in, but most of the time men aren't allowed in either. But still, every now and then, some kid gets ahead of themselves and goes through the sacred rope to enter the mountain anyway. Apparently one of my older brother's friends did this once, and once the village chief and his cohorts caught wind of this, they dragged the guy to a nearby temple, and for 3 days and three nights, he wasn't even allowed to sleep. He was violently assaulted the whole time. Having heard that, naturally we never even went close to the mountain. And for us village kids, that mountain was the scariest thing of all. And yet, once every few years or so, the period of time was irregular, they allowed people to go in. On this particular year, it was October. The leaves on the mountain were beginning to change colour, and a wind with the smell of winter in it blew as the blue sky spread out high above. All the 11 and 12-year-old boys were gathered, told to put on white clothing, and then made to climb the mountain. But they reminded everyone of one thing. You mustn't utter a single word once you step foot on that mountain. I first heard 10 days beforehand that I would have to take part in this strange event. I was already nearly in tears when my parents told me. It's the village's decision. You can't escape it. We do feel bad for you, but please endure it, my parents said and lowered their heads. I was unable to refuse them. The days passed quickly. I was completely forbidden from going outside and my meals changed completely. My beloved meat, like hamburg steak and yakitori, disappeared from the dinner table, and instead I was fed a vegetable diet like the elderly might like. And these vegetables were only topped with salt because other seasonings were forbidden, so I felt like a rabbit in a cage as I munched on them. The day before, I was forbidden from eating any proper meals, and all I was allowed was water and salt. That was it. Thanks to this lifestyle, I visibly lost weight, and I dropped 6 kilos over 10 days. Before the sun rose on the day, at about 4 or 5 a.m., my parents woke me up and told me to put on the white clothes they bought for me from somewhere. I was exhausted because I hadn't eaten the day before, and sleepy because it was so early, so I kept staggering around. I was barely awake, and then several adults also in white clothes, like me, arrived at our house. After they were done talking to my parents, they ushered me into a station wagon, and then we set off for the mountain in question. We drove along a countryside road with no street lights for a while, and then silently pulled to a stop. After getting into the car, I remember feeling a little relieved when the car stopped. The strange atmosphere created by the adults had made me curl up like a borrowed cat. When I got out, A, B, C, and D were there. They were the same age as me. Everybody looked unwell and haggard, in complete contrast to only 10 days earlier. We're about to enter the mountain. I think you already know, but you mustn't speak until we tell you it's okay," a man dressed in white like us said. His face was also covered in white cloth, so we couldn't read his expression. But the seriousness of his manner scared us, and so we nodded our heads. Once we were on the mountain, it was just like hell. People weren't normally allowed to climb it, so there were no paths. We made our way silently towards the top as we tread on old leaves and grass. We hadn't eaten or slept well, so it was hard to keep our footing even on flat ground. But do you know how hard it is to climb this pathless mountain in silence before the sun had even come up? Not to mention that we were children at the time. I had no idea why they were torturing us like that, and all I wanted to do was run away. But I wasn't able to. That man from earlier led us, while other men dressed the same surrounded us. In that inexpressible atmosphere, we climbed the pathless mountain, and then, when we reached the top, there was a small shrine. Even now, there's still no way to confirm what was enshrined there, but it was small enough that it would barely fit 10 small children in it. The adults ushered us 5 kids inside, and we quietly opened our mouths as they handed out sake and salt. "Once you have drunk the sake, we will have you descend the mountain one by one. Once you leave the shrine, head straight down the mountain. It doesn't matter which way. And like we said before, you mustn't speak a word until you reach the bottom of the mountain." Then the man told us that we could speak to each other as long as we were inside the shrine. But whatever happened on the mountain, we were not to turn back and not to raise our voices. And if we heard the sound of drums, we were to leave the shrine and head for the bottom of the mountain. Then he left with the other adults in white, who were apparently waiting outside the shrine. Us kids were frantic. The sun hadn't yet risen, and the only light we had was a candle that man lit. The faces projected in the eerily lit shrine were those of familiar friends, but they all looked like mummies whose spirits had been stripped away. "What's going on?" "I don't know."
"I want my mummy."
"What the hell? Damn it!" At first we all yelled and complained about the adults, but the fear and despair of being left alone on that terrifying mountain and the anxiety of not knowing what was going to happen next overwhelmed us. In the end, we all waited in silence for the sound of the drums. As we waited, we suddenly heard the sound of heavy drums coming from nowhere in particular. A, the youngest, jumped and started shaking when he heard the sound, letting out an inaudible gasp. But it seemed he couldn't stand the atmosphere in the shrine or our stairs any longer, so he opened the door and ran outside. When I looked through the open door, I saw the sun rise directly opposite us, and strangely, that was the only time I felt at ease. 20 or 30 minutes passed. We didn't have much to say, so we just stared at the floor and waited for the sound of the drums again. I wondered if there might be a gap in the shrine somewhere, as the cold air made me shiver. Those of us remaining huddled together for warmth, and then we heard the banging of the drums again. Hearing that, B stood up without hesitation and left the shrine. Another 20 or 30 minutes later, C left, and then finally D left as well. I was the only person remaining in the shrine. Until that point, the others had been there with me, so I was okay. But now that I really was all alone, I trembled in fear. I had lost all sense of time by then as well. I hugged my knees tight, and the fear and isolation almost crushed me. That was why, when I finally heard the sound of the drums, I was happy rather than scared. Finally, I could break free from that fear. With that in mind, I opened the door of the shrine and was greeted by a plain, ordinary mountain. The sun hadn't risen when we entered the shrine, so we couldn't get a good look at things, but for a mountain we all feared, it looked disappointingly normal. The morning air was fresh, and colourful leaves rustled in the breeze. The sun bounced off the morning rain, making it seem like there was a carpet of light. What the? It's just a normal mountain, I caught myself about to say, and then I started descending. It was only a few minutes later that I started to sense something was wrong. The mountain was too quiet for the time of morning. If you've ever been to a mountain, then you'll know that there are all sorts of things that can make noise. The murmur of a stream, the chirping of birds, the rustling of leaves, and the sound of small insects. I couldn't hear any of it. All I could hear was the sound of my own footsteps on the leaves below, and the blowing of the cold wind. When I realized that, an indescribable fear washed over me. So this mountain really wasn't normal. But despite the fact I was afraid, I couldn't force myself to go any faster. My hunger and lack of sleep cursed me. I forced my staggering legs forward and slowly descended the mountain. Around the time I reached the halfway point, I noticed something strange again. It felt like somebody was watching me, but when I looked around, all I could see were thin trees and dried leaves. This is the sacred mountain. Everyone else should have already reached the bottom by now, so I'm no doubt just imagining things, I tried telling myself and kept moving. But next, I sensed someone talking behind me. Not just one or two people, though. I could hear numerous children's voices. I almost screamed, but I covered my mouth with the palm of my hand. Instead, I took off running. I fell down the slope numerous times, but I kept running, and before long, presences behind me disappeared. It was hard to breathe thanks to my dry throat, and the lack of oxygen in my blood was making things fuzzy. But still, I crawled forward, trying to escape from that fear. That was when it happened. Suddenly, I heard my mother call out my name from behind. I turned around before I could stop myself. My mother wasn't there. Instead, there was a young boy just like me, dressed in white clothing. For a moment, I thought it was one of my friends who went down before me, but we were strictly warned not to speak, so it couldn't have been. Besides that, I didn't recognize his face either. Our village wasn't that big. I knew all the kids around my age. So then, who on earth was this boy? While I was racking my brains, the boy smiled as though remembering a funny joke, and then spoke. Come on, let's go together. The moment I heard those words, I got goosebumps all over. My heart warmed and I couldn't stop crying, even though I wasn't sad. Come, let's go. The boy got closer. Strangely, I couldn't hear the sound of the leaves being crushed beneath his feet. Come! When he was finally within arm's reach, the sound of the drums I'd heard back at the shrine rumbled in my ears like the earth was shaking. I looked away from the boy and turned to see rotten sacred rope and the adults playing the drums at the foot of the mountain. I hadn't even realized I was almost at the bottom. I ran desperately, ducking under the rope and heading towards those waiting at the foot of the mountain. As I reached the bottom, I don't know what the adults were thinking, but they poured copious amounts of sake and salt all over me. I was exhausted. Then they wrapped me in a large piece of paper and roughly threw me into the back of a truck. I didn't have the energy to fight back, so I just rocked back and forth as they drove, cold and hungry, before falling asleep. When I woke up, I was in my own bed at home. According to my parents, I'd slept for 3 days and three nights straight. Apparently, the village chief and the Shinto priest had told my parents to prepare for the worst. So, when I opened my eyes, they were shocked, like the dead had just come back to life before them. Once they calmed down, I asked them what on earth happened up there, but they had no clear answer for me. All they could say was that bad things lurked on that mountain, and what I saw must have been Tempopo Sama. As for the other kids who joined me up on the mountain, apparently nobody tried to speak to them, nor did they feel anyone looking at them as they descended. After I recovered, the village chief told me that no child had ever returned after being spoken to by Tempopo Sama. If he spoke to anyone, that meant that he liked them, and that meant you would be spirited away. But in my case, he didn't know whether I was just lucky or whether Tempopo Sama let me go on a whim. Hearing that, I couldn't help but wonder whether Tempopo Sama would have taken me away and I would have died if the scales had tipped just slightly. At the same time, I couldn't help but feel fear and disdain for the adults who accepted this as a village tradition. It was that village chief and Shinto priest. All of this happened roughly 10 years ago. Life went on and I graduated high school without problem. I then left the village. I rarely went back after that, but just recently I returned for personal reasons, so I asked my father and the former village chief about that mountain. At first, both were reluctant to talk about it, but I was able to get them to open up because I was an adult and I had been there at the time. First, the mountain. They said it had long been a place where evil energies gathered, a type of parallel reality to our own. There were no shortage of Oni and Tengu tales, and it was said that if women or children entered the mountain, misfortune would befall them within days. So much malice and evil had seeped into the land that it couldn't be purified, and it kept accumulating. Unable to bear the sight of this, the villagers decided to seal the mountain with sacred rope, but this didn't have any effect. The evil spirits overflowed and caused natural disasters such as droughts, floods, famines, and epidemics in the village every few years. And that was how the strange custom came to be. Young boys who had not yet reached puberty, yet were physically strong and full of life, were gathered and cleansed for 9 days before being sent up the mountain. One of them was to be a sacrifice. It was hoped that this would cleanse the mountain of evil. And it actually worked. The disasters stopped, like they'd never happened at all, and the fear people felt towards the mountain dissipated with time. Just when people started to think that the mountain was no longer to fear, as long as they regularly sent up sacrifices, an unprecedented famine hit the village. It was the Great Tempo Famine of 1833. This famine was so bad it even shook the Edo shogunate, and it hit our village without exception, killing numerous people. And that's where the custom then came into play. If the mountain caused the famine, then the villagers could not only provide it an offering, thereby lowering the number of mouths to feed, but they could eat the boy's flesh as well. 2 birds with 1 stone. They were apparently very happy about this. These days, that act would be barbaric, but the situation at the time must have been unspeakably awful. And so, by the time the famine ended 2 years later, more than 50 boys had been sacrificed to the mountain, and their lingering resentment merged with that of the evil mountain to create a monster. And that monster was Tempopo Sama. If we included the boys who were sacrificed before the famine, then there were probably more than 100 angry spirits there, being absorbed into the evil land. By combining the malice of the land with the boys who had been sacrificed to it, the scale of it was unimaginable. The village reportedly sought numerous well-known psychics to see if they could appease Tempopo Sama, who haunted the mountain, but they apparently all froze whenever they saw it. That's not something that can be exorcised by humans. It will need to be managed for many hundreds of years, and all you can do is reduce its power slowly. And so, it's the duty of those born into the village to manage the mountain. As a descendant of those who killed innocent boys as offerings for the mountain, it may be my natural duty as well. But when I look at the face of my newborn son, I can't help but think, please don't let him suffer the same fate as me when he turns 12. Next up sees us visiting a small seaside village with a family that does things a little differently. They have some odd funeral customs, but it seems they exist for a very good reason. Find out why in The Day You Mustn't Look at the Sea. In September, my grandma's sister, we called her Olbar, passed away, and so our entire family gathered to visit for the funeral and wake. She was actually the eldest person in our family at the time, and for some reason, the women in our family hold all the power, so distant relatives from all over came for her funeral. One of these relatives was a boy a year younger than me by the name of Shu-chan. He was the only relative that I could hang out with. It had been about 15 years since we last saw each other, but his parents and older sister were the only ones who came for the wake. I didn't see Shu-chan anywhere. At the time, I suddenly remembered that when I was in elementary school, there was another funeral. I think it was Olba's husband, and Shu-chan and I had a scary experience there while we were playing together. My father's side of the family is a little strange. It's not the eldest son who succeeds the family, but the eldest daughter. All of my dad's side, including Olbar, lived on the Sea of Japan side of the country, but my dad was the third son, so he moved away from home to live in Osaka instead. As such, he had nothing to do with that particular family custom. Shu-chan's family, like ours, also moved away and lived in Kanagawa. Every year during the summer holidays, we all visited Olbar's house a little before Obon and took part in Buddhist rituals, visited festivals, and spent time together as a family. Unlike others, my family and Shu-chan's family had to come from far away, so we always spent several days there. And because her house was close to the beach, you could see it from the street, Shu-chan and I would spend all our time there, from morning till night. In the winter of my second or third year of elementary school, there was a funeral at Olba's house. I think it was for her husband. We stayed there to attend the funeral and wake, and Shu-chan's family did the same. I've always been pretty carefree, but at the time, I was even more so. All I could think about was being able to play with Shu-chan rather than the funeral. We left home in the morning, arrived at Olbar's house, had dinner, and then a short while later, went to the wake. All I remember is that there was nothing to do there, and I was bored out of my brains. I couldn't play anywhere. There was a detached part of the house that we usually stayed in whenever we visited, but there were so many people there for the funeral that it was full. We ended up sleeping in the main house. After dinner, I remember someone saying, "Why would he die on a day like this?" When I woke up the next morning at 6 a.m, Olba, my grandma, and some other relatives were rushing about. They were hanging up small baskets. They seemed to be woven out of wood or something, which had strange pieces of paper attached. They were all hanging by a single piece of string from the doors and windows, so I hit them and played with them until my dad walloped me on the head. Before long, they started to close all the shutters, or maybe wicket gates, I don't know. And in the kitchen, which had no shutter, they covered the window with a large piece of Japanese paper fastened to the frame. My first thought was that this must be some sort of custom they did when someone died. The funeral service started early in the morning, and although I don't remember much of it, it was over just after lunch. I may have been a heartless child, but all I could think about was playing once the funeral was over. We had lunch after that, and I remember nobody said a whole lot. I don't remember what time it was, but most of our relatives left pretty soon after. My family and Shu-chan's family were the only ones left. I imagined it would be just like the summer holidays, where we all chatted and had fun. But I still remember the adults getting angry at me just for talking to Shu-chan. "Be quiet," they said when we were playing in the house. That night, when I said I wanted to watch TV, they got angry at me again. "Just be quiet," they said. Thinking about it now, none of the adults said anything that day. Since I was so bored, I talked to Shu-chan and suggested we go to the beach. He agreed. As I was putting my shoes on by the front door, my grandma's face changed color and she rushed over, hit me on the head, and then dragged me back into the dining room. Shu-chan's father was there and he looked at us with a stern expression on his face. "You mustn't go outside today. Go upstairs." The two of us went upstairs and barely spoke a word for the rest of the day. We played Othello and then at some point fell asleep. I don't know how long I slept for, but when I woke up, I was cold. When I went downstairs, I smelt a fishy odour, a little more salty than a fishing spot. I went to the living room to check the time, and Olba and my parents were reading the newspaper and such there. Nobody was talking. The place felt uncomfortable, so after I was done in the toilet, I went to go back upstairs, when I ran into Shu-chan in the hall. "Hey, I heard that somebody's coming here tonight," he said. Apparently the adults had said something about it that morning, and Shu-chan overheard them. I wanted to check outside, but all the shutters were closed, and I couldn't see anything. "I wonder if the window in the toilet still opens." I remembered the tiny frosted glass window in the toilet. It didn't have shutters. The toilet was at the end of the house facing the ocean, so the two of us decided to go and check it out. The toilet was cold in winter, but the thought that there might be someone on the other side of that window was exciting, like being holed up in a secret hideout. At the same time, a chill ran down my spine. "Are you sure someone's really out there?" I whispered to Shu-chan. "That's what they said," he whispered back. The toilet window was located up high, so being an elementary school student, I couldn't see at it just standing there. The toilet water supply pipe was there, so I stood on that to look outside. I went first. I opened the window quietly, so as not to make a sound, and looked outside. A basket swung under the eaves. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw something long stretched out from the road to the house. I couldn't see what it was very well, but the tip of that long thing appeared to be getting closer. I watched it for about 10 seconds before I trembled and closed the window in fear. "Did you see anyone?" "I don't know, but something was out there."
"I want to see it too."
"Whatever it was coming this way. We should go." I think I was almost in tears. I was so cold and terrified that I wanted to scream and run away. "Come on, let's go." I opened the toilet door and tried to pull Shu-chan out.
"I want to see it too. Just for a second. Just for a second, okay?"
He shook me off and then climbed onto the water pipe. He slid the window open and looked outside. After a while, he stood there, frozen.
"Hey, that's enough, yeah? Let's go already." "Hey, look."
He stopped mid-sentence and his throat seemed to close up. I had no idea what was going on, and while I was confused, I heard a noise coming from behind me.
"What are you doing?"
Shu-chan's father stood behind us with a terrifying expression on his face. Before I could say another word, let alone make excuses, Shu-chan's father grabbed my collar and yanked me out of the toilet into the hall. A moment later, he yanked Shu-chan out as well. Then he slammed the toilet door shut. Olbar came running at the sound. "You fool!" My father hit me, and Olbar grabbed me. "Did you see it? Did you see it?" I thought she was angry, but she looked like she was about to cry. I had no idea what was going on, but the adults acting so seriously made me even more frightened.
"I looked outside, but it was too dark to see anything, so I quickly gave up."
"Are you sure? You didn't see its face?" she said, getting angry, and I nodded through my tears. Behind us, my father and grandma blocked the front of the toilet with a large package. "Shuji, what about you?" Shu-chan's father said, grabbed him by the shoulders and shook him. Worried, I turned to look at him as well. Shu-chan was smiling. He made a sound that sounded like hiccuping, but his face was strained, like it was both smiling and crying at the same time.
"Shuji! Shuji!"
His father shook him and called out his name, but he gave no response. For a moment, everyone fell silent, and the sight in the hall made us all tremble in fear. They undressed Shu-chan and took him to the family altar room in the back of the house. Oba ran off to make a call somewhere, while Shu-chan's mother and older sister sat in the living room, their faces pale. Then Oba returned. "As soon as dawn breaks, we'll take Shuji to see Tol-san. I couldn't catch the whole name," she said. Shu-chan's parents just nodded. Then my grandma and parents grabbed my arms and dragged me upstairs. They made me strip off and crawl under the covers of a nearby blanket. "You mustn't leave this room for the rest of the night," my grandma said, and then she left. I heard what sounded like a short chant from the other side of the closed door. I spent the rest of that night huddled with my parents. I was too scared to turn off the lights, so I clung to their legs under the blankets, trembling. For some reason, my hands and feet were unreasonably cold. The next morning, Grandma came to get me. We went downstairs and Shu-chan was gone. "Shuji had a fever, so he's at the hospital," was all they would tell me. When I left the bedroom, I saw the same baskets that were hanging around the house and windows the day before, also hanging in front of the room I spent the night in. "You boys really did something stupid," Olbar said as I was eating breakfast. My parents were getting ready for us to leave, and once I was done eating, we were going to leave right away. I apologized to Olbar and my grandma, and then we left. When we got home that night, I broke out in a fever and missed school the next day. And that's the end of the story from my childhood. The year after that, my parents stopped taking me back to Olbar's house. We only went back once, during the summer holidays of my second year at junior high. Our relatives were all there, but I didn't see Shu-chan anywhere. "Shuji can't come because he has too much work to do for cram school," his mother said. But at Olbar's funeral this September, I heard something else from another relative. "Shuji-kun really is strange now, huh?" I don't know what Shu-chan saw that time. I don't know what I saw either. But when I asked my father about it, he just said, "There are some days where you mustn't look at the sea." For our last story this week, we're taking a step back in time to the Taisho period, the beginning of the 20th century, a time when monsters and superstitions were far more widely believed, and if this story is anything to go by, for good reason. This one's called The Truth About Being Spirited Away. M- My great-grandmother apparently came from a village in the mountains of central Japan. Her parents died when she was a child, and her brother left for work, so she was taken in by the village headman's family. She became the playmate and attendant of the headman's daughter, who was 2 years older than her. They taught her not just etiquette, but how to read and write as well, although they were strict about it. Perhaps because they were so close in age, the headman's daughter was just like an older sister to her, and she doted on my great-grandmother like she really was her younger sister. When she was in what we would now call the second grade of junior high, there was a problem in my great-grandmother's village. First, the village's outcast died. He didn't believe in religion, so he urinated on sacred statues and rocks, kicked offerings around, and went into places he shouldn't. Moreover, he claimed to have seen a tengu, and that there were monsters in the treetops, and in the evenings, he'd hang from the tree branches screaming and pouring water on people. Even his parents gave up on him. When he died, the villagers started to whisper that he had been cursed by the Kamisama, or that it was a tengu's curse. He was found dead under a tall tree in the mountains, so people said it had to be the work of a tengu. Before long, other people in the village started having accidents as well, one after the other. People tripping on familiar roads or falling from trees. These small accidents kept building, and villagers whispered that it had to be a tengu's curse. At first, some people tried to stop those rumours from spreading, but before long, they were everywhere. Some people even fled the village, in fear of being cursed themselves. There were all sorts of discussions on how to stop the curse. Some people suggested they make a sacrifice to the tengu, which scared my great-grandmother to death. Sacrifices always meant young girls. Since they were a village in the mountains, there were few young girls there. And, being that she had no blood relatives around, she feared that the sacrifice would undoubtedly be her. After some discussion, the village headman persuaded everyone by saying he would pay for a shaman from another village to come and see what was going on. Several men set out to fetch her, but 2 weeks passed and they still hadn't returned. Whenever my great-grandmother and the headman's daughter left the house, she felt eyes always watching her, so she ended up barely leaving the house at all. The senior maids and servants also stopped talking about the curse. Then, the village headman's health took a turn for the worse. It was decided that a sacrifice needed to be made. My great-grandmother knew that it would be her, and she was terrified of what was to come. Yet, the headman's daughter continued acting the same, as though nothing had changed. Then one day, the daughter disappeared. When my great-grandmother woke up that morning and went to find her, she was gone. The shutters were locked from the inside and her bed was still warm. On top of her blanket was a single leaf from a tree that grew up in the mountains. Her kimono and sandals were gone, but everything else was still there. There was a big fuss. Some people thought she ran away, while others said she must have been taken by a tengu. It was impossible for the young woman to climb the mountain in just her sandals. More and more people started to believe that a tengu had taken her. It was around this time that the men who had set out to fetch the shaman returned. My great-grandmother apparently trembled at the sight of her. This old shaman built a massive altar and then prayed to the Kamisama. Then she gathered all of the villagers and told them off. According to the shaman, everything that was going on was caused by the villagers' lack of belief. The first man who died, died from his own actions. Because he continued to offend the Kamisama, neither the village nor the mountain Kamisama were able to protect him. Then, when he tried to climb a tree, he slipped and fell to his death. And apparently, there really was a tengu. But this tengu hadn't always been around. It was a messenger for the great tengu and was on his way back when he came across the dead man's body. This defilement was so great that the Tengu could no longer leave and was stuck on the mountain until that impurity could be cleansed. And so, that was why the Kami-sama of the village and the mountain were angry. The villagers had upset the Tengu, so their response was natural. Their impiety was what caused the succession of accidents and injuries. And because they blamed all of that on the Kami-sama, they got angry and stopped protecting them. As for the village headman's daughter, she was apparently spirited away. Because the villagers were trying to do something unreasonable with her, the Kami-sama felt bad for her and took her away. Because she would be unable to return from their domain, the shaman told the villagers to pray to the girl as a Kami-sama as well. The villagers reflected on their actions, apologized to the Kami-sama, and prayed to the daughter as well. They also built a shrine to her in her father's house and prayed to her there as well. My great-grandmother continued to work at the village headman's house after that, but because his daughter was gone, she left town to be with her brother instead. Apparently the headman gave her a nice severance pay when she left, and he took care of a lot of stuff for her later wedding as well. She also received one of the headman's daughter's combs, which she treasured and kept with her always. But then, during the war, it was burnt and destroyed during an air raid. And with that, her last connection with her hometown was gone. She cried as she told the story. When I said that the Kami-sama were horrible for taking the daughter away, she got mad at me. She then told me one more thing. On the day she disappeared, my great-grandmother opened the shutters and found that the bolts weren't down. And so, she thought that maybe the daughter left by herself. But there really was a leaf on her bed, and it was from a tree that could only be found up the mountain. The shaman seemed to know what was going on, so she mentioned the bolts to her. Then the shaman told her to keep quiet about that. The girl had been taken by a Kami-sama. That was the most important thing. Hearing that, my great-grandmother cried. Don't forget to check out Bunkai, Baffling Japanese Internet Mysteries Volume 2, available on Amazon right now, and our newly revamped merchandise store at koobana.store. And if you'd like to chat about this week's stories, come and join us in the Koobana Discord. You can find that link in the description or on koobana.net. You can also check out our Patreon at patreon.com/TaraA.Devlin for exclusive bonus stories and extras, or our YouTube channel at youtube.com/koobanajapan for all sorts of Japanese horror you won't find anywhere else. Thanks, guys. Stay safe, and I'll see you again next time for even more Koobana, true Japanese scary stories from around the internet. Want even more scary stories? Head over to koobana.net for new translations every week. You can also join our Patreon for exclusive stories you won't find anywhere else. Head over to koobana.net now.